You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Hey, music lovers, welcome back to Modern Musicology. My name is Alan, and I got a couple of great co-hosts with me. First is Stephanie Seymour.
Hello, everybody.
And there's also this guy called Rob Levy.
Hey, you're never too old to rock and roll.
Right on. And we have a very special guest that's joining us today. We have drummer and visual artist Michael Cardelloni. Born and raised in Cleveland, Ohio, Michael is best known as the drummer for Damn Yankees and Except in the 90s, and since 1999 has been the drummer for Lynyrd Skynyrd. He's worked with many other artists over the years, like Peter Frampton, John Fogerty, Freddie Mercury, Eddie Jobson, Tommy Shaw, and lots of others. But he's also an accomplished visual artist. His work has been featured on NBC, CBS, CNN, twice on the cover of Fine Arts Magazine, and in a full spread article in the Washington Post. His work has had gallery exhibitions in New York City, Los Angeles, Phoenix, Long Island, and Las Vegas, amongst other places, and will be featured in a brand new exhibition called Bella Italia this May in Asheville, North Carolina. Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Alan.
Thanks. We're so excited that you're here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to meet you. Let's start with the dual role that visual art and music have played over the course of your life. You discovered a love for both art and music at a very young age, and you developed both professionally pretty much in parallel with each other. So talk a little bit about the role that art and music have played in your life. And was there ever a time that you thought you might pursue one and not the other?
Well, this is a good place to start, Alan.
I'm glad I picked it then.
and starting with the art makes the most sense because the art was before the music. When I was in kindergarten, the teacher had seen something that she mentioned to my parents. You know, he really seems to take to painting. You may want to encourage this. So the summer in between kindergarten and first grade, my parents enrolled me in the Cleveland Institute of Art, Cleveland, Ohio, where I'm from. Mm-hmm. And it was a summer course basically teaching all the proper principles of fine art to a four-year-old.
Yeah, that's...
I was absolutely the youngest person in the room. And I would like to think maybe some of that stuck with me, but I'm sure most of it went over my head.
Yeah.
I will tell you that summer, I did a painting of the Planters Mr. Peanut guy, you know, with the monocle and the top hat.
Yeah.
And the cane. I still have that painting, actually, and it's not bad for a four-year-old.
Wow. That's amazing.
I loved Charles Schulz and the Peanuts comics.
Yeah.
And for most of my single digit years, I thought I was going to be an artist. It was all I did. Drawing, painting.
Yeah.
And then I started to play drums when I was 9. And that quickly moved to the forefront. However, I loved drawing and painting so much, and it was a part of my daily life that it continued, and consequently, both continued my entire life. So at no point have I ever really just focused on one, even though the music career, thankfully, kicked into gear when I was in my 20s, and we can talk about that later on. The painting was omnipresent, and the visual art and the music were literally coexisting. And they represent for me a perfect balance. I can't imagine just doing one and not the other because they've been connected in my brain since I was a little kid. And I wouldn't want to only do one because I don't know how to only do one.
Well, they're both artistic outlets, obviously, in a different way, right? One is you're on stage in front of a whole bunch of people getting immediate feedback, and the other is like you're solo, you know, just doing your thing, and then you get feedback afterwards, I guess.
Truly, you know, it's the perfect balance. One is public and loud, and the other is private and quiet.
Yeah.
I've learned how to have both of them always right at arm's reach. And, you know, for example, today I was painting all day. Mm-hmm. Tomorrow I'll be on a plane heading to a Skynyrd gig. So,
right.
You know, it's one or the other. I've said this before, on any given day, I'm a drummer who paints or a painter who drums.
Right.
Were you introduced to drums in through school, or was this just something on your own outside, separate from school?
Thank you, Stephanie. That's a good question, because I can now tip the hat to my cousin Bert.
So, okay.
Cousin Bert had a drum set. And whenever we would go visit his family, I would beg him to let me play his drums. And every now and then he would agree. My parents saw how fixated I was, 9 years old at the time. So they arranged that I would start taking lessons with Bert's teacher. So, you know, thank you, Bert.
Yeah, thanks, Bert.
Both Stephanie and I are drummers.
Yes. And really? I got introduced at a young age too, but it was more sort of like my idea. It runs my family too. Like my uncle and my cousins all play, but I saw the Go-Go's and that was it for me.
Nice. That was a great band.
Yeah.
We talked about you being from Cleveland. When people think about rock music scenes, some of the names that come up are always like New York, LA, Detroit, London, Seattle, Nashville, you know, those kind of places, Liverpool, Athens, and all those places have distinct sounds and a distinct music history. What do you think sets Cleveland apart? What makes Cleveland unique and special as a music scene?
Well, a disc jockey named Alan Freed coined the term rock and roll
in
Cleveland. So that's why we've always called ourselves the home of rock and roll. And fittingly, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is in Cleveland. Does Cleveland have a sound? Well, perhaps. There was a wonderful man, rest in peace, who was a friend of mine named Michael Stanley. And Michael had a band that was monstrous, being the hometown hero, as it were. And you did not grow up in Cleveland and not have that be kind of your, you know, the through line of your high school years, hearing Michael Stanley Band. And that, yeah. I think that his music did trickle into the music scene. You know, Cleveland is a real melting pot for music. When I was playing the club scene, which would have been back in the early 80s, it almost had kind of a new wave eccentricity to it in a way. I certainly, you know, had a lot of clothing with zebra stripes and leopard spots on it.
Yes. I think we all did.
I think I still have with all those bands, actually. But, you know, Cleveland is a great music town. I certainly cut my teeth playing in bands there. Literally, the first professional job I did was at a bar in Cleveland, and I was 11. And I got paid $3 that night. And I should mention, I have worked for less since.
Oh, that's great.
Could I jump forward to when you were, I guess, how did you end up in New York City? What made you move there? And I know at such a young age, you really got, I think, was it 22 when you got hooked up with the Damn Yankees, or was it after that?
Damn Yankees was just a few years later, but you are correct. At age 22, I moved to New York. Okay. And the reason I did that was I grew up loving British progressive rock, bands like King Crimson and Yes. And there was a band in the late 70s called UK, which was a British progressive rock band. And for all of my musician friends and myself, we loved this band because it was very advanced musically, and for a young musician trying to push their own envelope to listen to music so difficult to perform, gave us something to strive toward. So one of the founding members of UK is a man named Eddie Jobson. And Eddie is a keyboardist and plays electric violin. He had been in Roxy Music. He had been in Yes for a period of time. He played in Frank Zappa's band for a period of time, Jethro Tull. So Eddie was doing a solo project called Zinc in the early 80s. And I basically just started sending him fan letters. And one thing led to another, and the fan letters turned into a resume and a videotape, followed by my going up to New York City to audition for him for that Zinc project. And I moved to New York to work with Eddie. So when I was 22, I moved here, where I am right now, to New York City. And we had a recording project working on new material for that Zinc band. This went on for a few years. We never performed live because it was strictly a recording studio project. During this time, I was making my living with my fine art. I worked in the garment district in Manhattan for a children's clothing company, and I was in the art department hand painting designs, bunnies and duckies and things like that. So I was painting bunnies and duckies and then drumming at night with Eddie Jobson. My other drummer friends started to land tours, which looked a lot better than painting bunnies. So I spoke to Eddie and I said, would you mind if I try to land a tour? And he said, no. He said, I encourage that. It would be a great experience for you to get that under your belt. So I started networking in the city. You know, I was an incredibly small fish in an incredibly large pond here in New York. 22-year-old kid who really didn't have a lot to show in the way of a resume. But I heard that Tommy Shaw was putting a band together, and I called the management office, and the man on the phone asked me, so, you know, well, what have you done? And I said, well, you know, I'm from Cleveland. I've only been here for a little while, but I'm in this recording project with this man named Eddie Jobson. And he said, Eddie Jobson? He goes, I know exactly who that is. If wow. you work with Eddie Jobson, you can definitely come in and audition for Tommy.
Nice. Wow.
And what I learned was this man at the management office was a Juilliard graduate. So he would have been one of those kind of advanced musicians that would have known someone like Eddie and appreciated what Eddie had done. So I went into this audition. I auditioned against 25 other drummers. I landed the gig. And initially, they didn't really know what we were going to do. Tommy had just released a solo album. This is in 1987.
Okay.
And that record was called Ambition.
Mm-hmm.
So we just started rehearsing at night, but I was still painting bunnies during the day. And then one day, Tommy's manager called the office and said, you need to take a leave of absence from your day job because you are going on tour. The Tommy Shaw Band is going to be the opening act for Rush for the next 4 months. And next week, you're going to play Madison Square Garden.
Oh, my God.
It was insane. It was baptism by fire. I was not prepared for that kind of a jump.
But not many people have that story, man.
No, it was incredible. It was an amazing experience. Very early into the tour, we went into Cleveland and played the 20,000-seat arena where I had gone to my first concert years before. All of my family were there. It was an amazing moment.
So I have to know, during this tour, did you get a chance to meet Neil Peart?
Neil Peart and I, God bless him, rest in peace. Neil Peart and I very quickly became buddies on that tour. It was the Hold Your Fire tour, 1987 and 1988. And not only did we become friends then, but we remained friends right up until he passed away.
Mm. Wow.
And every time Rush would come into town, I would go down and spend the day with him at Madison Square Garden. When I would go out to Los Angeles, I would visit with him out there. You know, Neil was an author and wrote a fair amount of books. And
yeah.
He was kind enough to mention me in a couple of the books. One of the comments, and it's one of my favorite things that anyone has ever said, is I forget how he segued into it, but he said, you know, and my, you know, longtime friend, Michael Cardelloni, the drummer from Lynyrd Skynyrd. And then in parentheses, it says, which would surprise you if you knew him. He's a fine art painter and a sophisticated urbanite.
Wow.
Yeah.
Urbanite.
Urbanite. Oh, here's, and then in the other book, I'm not sure what the segue was, but when he mentioned me, he said, Michael, you know, longtime drummer Lynyrd Skynyrd, and then in parentheses, and by the way, his previous band was called Damn Yankees, but we'll leave that alone.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Yeah. He was a wonderful guy. I miss him. Miss him dearly.
Aww.
Backing up just a little bit, I'm very curious to know, when you auditioned for Damn Yankees, what did you audition with? What did they have you play? Did like Tommy pull out some stick songs or what happened?
Well, it wasn't an audition.
Ah.
What had happened was the Tommy Shaw Band had been working for 2 years. And during that time, Tommy was thinking about maybe trying something else. Maybe going back to Styx, maybe forming a new band. And by chance, his manager had just gotten off the phone with a record company executive in Los Angeles, a very well-known man named John Kalodner.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, know him.
Yeah, so he's a very historical guru of the music biz who has this knack for putting people together.
Yep.
You know, hey, Sammy Hagar, you should join Van Halen. Things
That's
like
right.
that. Well, John Kalodner had a phone call with Ted Nugent's manager, much in the same way that Tommy Shaw's manager had a conversation with John Kalodner, which was, my guy's looking for something to do. Do you have any ideas? And Kalodner said, well, what if Tommy and Ted get together and write?
Huh.
So the plan was going to be that Ted was going to fly into New York. They were going to use the Tommy Shaw Band rehearsal room, where conveniently my drums are sitting.
Mm-hmm.
So Tommy called one day and said, hey, I need you to come into the room tomorrow. Ted Nugent's going to fly in. He and I are just going to kind of jam and see if we have any chemistry. And we need, you know, you there. So we just kind of have something to play off of. And I said, okay, that's cool, cool. I hung up the phone and I thought, this is going to be really fun. And it is definitely not going to work.
Wow.
Because on paper,
yeah,
Tommy and Ted seem to be musically polar opposites.
Yeah.
But once they got in the room, I saw how much common thread they had from their R&B love that they grew up listening to. Very quickly after that initial get-together, and by the way, in that initial get-together, two songs from the first album, Come Again and Mystified, both happened in that room, in that
place. Oh, wow. That's really cool.
About a month later, Tommy called again and said, hey, you know, Ted's going to fly in, but now Jack Blades, the bass player from Night Ranger, is going to fly in.
Yeah.
And I said, great. And once I heard Jack, I realized, oh, Jack is the perfect middle point between Tommy and Ted. Jack had some of the sensibilities that Ted had, some of the sensibilities that Tommy had, and he just became the perfect balance. And in that get together, we came up with Coming of Age and High Enough.
Oh my gosh.
Wow.
The chemistry was just flying off of the shelves at this thing. Well, I will tell you that I was sitting in that room looking at three very famous people thinking, oh boy, my days are numbered here.
Right.
There's no way I'm making the cut here because this is quickly turning into an all-star band. And then that kid from Cleveland.
Yeah.
But what happened was Kalodner flew into New York, listened to us rehearse in that room, liked what he heard, and then said, I want to see this happen in front of an audience. Mm-hmm. So we went to a little club, now defunct, on the Upper West Side of Manhattan called the China Club.
Oh my God, I went there all the time.
Did you really?
Yeah, like okay. All the time.
So the China Club, for those who don't know, was this very underground, cool.
Literally
underground. You'd have to go down like two long flights of stairs. But it's the kind of place where on any given night you would see, hey, Jeff Beck just got up with the local band playing. Oh, there's Bowie dancing on the, you know, on the dance floor. It was one of those places.
Julian Lennon was always there. And like,
I used to see Julian all the time. So we, the Damn Yankees, and we already had the name, by the way, we went to the China Club. The band that was playing took a break. The four of us walked on stage and you saw all the heads start to turn in the club because they saw who was walking up there.
Right.
Three very famous people and then some unknown kid from Cleveland. And we just started playing. And Kalodner was standing in the middle of the club with this huge smile. And he was just looking from left to right and watching people's reactions. And he was nodding affirmative that, oh yeah, this is real. And we ended up getting a record deal with Warner Brothers. And that first album went double platinum. And it was an unbelievable time of my life. It truly was the springboard for my career. I was, if memory serves, 28 when the first Damn Yankees album came out, which is 34 years ago. And I'm immensely proud to say that record still is selling.
Yeah.
So it must have struck a chord with people, but I could not be more proud of what the Damn Yankees did.
Do you like the idea of the term supergroup?
Related to Damn Yankees?
Yeah.
I think it's very applicable.
Yeah. Some people that are in supergroups don't, like with the Wilburys. They didn't like the term supergroup. Well, I've always wondered why people get that. Well,
but if you were to ask Tommy Shaw, Jack Blades, and Ted Nugent that question,
yeah,
they may answer it differently. You know, remember, I was this unknown kid when Damn Yankees happened. I was just ecstatic to be along for the ride.
Yeah.
So I was calling it a supergroup. Hey, I'm in a supergroup. Who are you? Doesn't matter.
And I think that's where most people first got to know you too, because we've been in email exchanges with your PR rep, and she's gotten us a number of different artists to interview on our show. And when she pitched your name, I was like, that's the guy from Damn Yankees. And except I would love to talk to that guy. Then I found out about the artwork and all the other stuff. And I was like, oh, we have got to have this guy on our show.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, Damn Yankees is where I first knew your name.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That really changed the ball game big time. No question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if you can say, but what happened with the Damn Yankees that only two albums happened? Was it Tommy going back to Styx?
We had a three-album deal. We did the first two. And then Ted had owed Atlantic Records a solo album for many, many years. And we had just finished a brutally long tour, and we all needed to take a break because it was 5 years of nonstop Damn Yankee work.
Mm. Yeah.
So Ted said, well, if we're going to go on this little break, you know, I'm going to go and bang out that solo album. And Tommy and Jack, who were always writing, had started writing some things that were different stylistically than Damn Yankees. And they ended up deciding to do a duet album, which was called Shaw Blades.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes.
So I played on the Shaw Blades record.
Mm-hmm.
I did some touring with them. And then I also did some touring with Ted. So we kind of went on this self-imposed hiatus for about a year. and we did these little side project, although it was still within this Damn Yankees umbrella because we were still all kind of working together. And then we got back together. If memory serves, it was 1995. And we started writing songs for the third album. But during that time, the Seattle grunge scene had just really taken a forefront in the type of music that was being recorded, the type of music that was being purchased. And a lot of bands were kind of being pushed off to the side that weren't part of this modern sound. And consequently, we just never really dove in earnest to that third Damn Yankees recording, because we would spend a few months and then the next summer would come up and Ted would have another tour and I would jump on that. Tommy, by this time, had rejoined Styx. Jack had reformed Night Ranger. So everyone went off and did a summer tour, but then we got back together and demoed up more songs. There are at least 20 Damn Yankee songs that no one has ever heard that we've
recorded.
And some really great stuff, too. And then simply, you know, the years just started ticking by.
Yeah.
I joined Skynyrd, and that's now 26 years ago. But I will say, because I get asked this at least once a week, and in almost every interview, when is Damn Yankees going to get back together? And the short answer is, never say never. I don't know if we ever will. I think we all would love to do it. There have been conversations where we get together on the phone and we try and find a slot, but it simply has just become a scheduling conflict. You know, you have four people with four separate demanding careers that are always overlapping. And even to try and find 1 month where all four of us have nothing going on so we can all get together and do something has proven to be a real problem. But maybe one day. I would happily do it in a heartbeat.
That's amazing. So, and I know you're still in touch with all those guys, right? You're still
absolutely.
All buddies.
I was just texting with Jack a few days ago because he celebrated his 70th birthday. Yeah, we've all stayed in touch and have remained good friends over the years.
That guy cannot be 70.
I know, seriously.
Unbelievable. I mean, I know Tommy is right at 70, if not.
Tommy is 71.
Yeah, that's right.
Jack just turned 70 on April 24th.
Wow.
And Ted, I think, is 95.
Ted is eternal.
Yes, he is. He'd be the first one to tell you.
Right. Well, we've gone about half of our time, so I think we really need to talk about some art.
Let's do that.
Yeah, absolutely. You got this exhibition coming up in May in Asheville, North Carolina, and you talk about an art town. Asheville is like one of the capitals of art in the U.S. Talk a little bit about this exhibition, and the centerpiece of this exhibition sounds really interesting. So give us a little info about that.
Well, you know, I was not really aware of how cool the Asheville art scene is until a year ago when my wife and I went to visit her brother who lives there. And he took us around this River Arts District.
Yeah.
And within a few blocks, there are a couple hundred artists and dozens of really cool galleries. And I just thought, having shown in galleries now, you know, for the past 15 years on a regular basis, and never having done anything in the in North Carolina or South Carolina for that matter, I thought, you know, I need to dip my toe in this town because there's so much cool stuff going on here. So there was one gallery and one artist in particular that really stood out to me. And he's a man named Philip D'Angelo. And Philip owns his own gallery right there in the River Arts District. He's incredibly popular and very, very successful in Asheville. So I just called him out of the blue. Having gone into his gallery, but then a few months later, I called him up and I told him, you know, that I had stopped in and how much I loved the space and how much I loved his work, and pitched the idea of he and I doing a joint show together. And he was responsive to that. And then the more we talked, we realized that we share a Sicilian ancestry, which was kind of fascinating that we both had that history. So both Phil and I have done our share of Italian themed paintings. So we already kind of had a head start in that direction. And we thought, well, let's have this be, you know, something that plays off of our shared ancestry. So the show is called Bella Italia, Beautiful Italy. And it happens Saturday, May 25. And Phil and I will be in the gallery from noon to 5 that day. And what we're doing is we are going to intermix our art. So it won't be half of the gallery is all mine, half is all his. We're mm-hmm. going to share the walls and kind of play off of each other's work. Mm. We have very different styles in the way we paint, so we won't be stepping on each other's toes at all. We will also each have a few other non-Italian themed works just to kind of round out the vocabulary. I have a few of my music themed paintings that will be in there. But we thought it would be interesting to have one painting where we both chose the exact same subject. And we both paint it and have those two paintings hang side by side right in the middle of the gallery as the focal point.
Wow.
So I have a lot of family down in Sicily and have gone down to visit them a few times. And on one of the trips, my wife Nancy and I went to a town called Taramina. And there is this gorgeous ancient Greek theater. And when I mean ancient, built in 300 AD.
Oh, man.
So it is this beautiful, crumbly ruins, and it's just gorgeous. So I told Phil, I said, you know, the Greek theater in Taramina is an instantly recognizable location for people that have visited Sicily. That would be a good subject. And he liked that. So we then went off on our own. And we're not telling each other what we're doing because we're keeping it a surprise for each other, which I think is the unveil is going to be very, very fun. You know, we're not telling each other the vantage point we're doing. Stylistically, we can anticipate what each other will do because of knowing each other's work. So even if we paint the exact vantage point, these are going to be very, very different works because they're being seen through two sets of eyes.
I love that idea.
Thank you. It's really going to be fun. And I'm happy to say that my painting is on the easel in the room across the hall here, finished. I haven't Ooh. Even told Phil I've finished mine yet. Leonard Skinner had an incredibly busy March and April on tour. You know, I would be on the road for 4 days, home for one, on the road for three, home for two. And any of those home days, when I wasn't doing laundry, I was painting. So over the course of the past 3 months, because I started it in January, I'm happy to say that the painting is finished. And I am incredibly proud of this landscape. It's a nice one.
And that's so exciting. I can't wait to see it.
Thank you, Stephanie. With all of my Italian paintings, I name them Italian. So this one is Teatro Greco, theater mm-hmm. Greek. The Italian, they kind of switch the sentences.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah.
There you go. So, anyway, So yes, that show is May 25th, and I'm incredibly excited about it.
Will it run? Will the paintings stay up for a while there? You know, how long will everything run?
The show will hang for 2 weeks.
Okay.
That's pretty standard. They leave the paintings up for a couple of weeks. We will be, my wife and I will drive down there because not only the Greek painting, but there's seven or eight others actually here in the room with me.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll have our little backseat of our Honda Civic loaded with paintings, driving down to Asheville.
I also heard, or I think I read in something, that you paint on the road. You don't just only paint at home, correct? You do take supplies on the road with you.
That is correct. I did not do it on this tour because we were on such a demanding travel schedule that I knew I wouldn't have the time to paint. But there have been many Lynyrd Skynyrd tours where I had a collapsible easel and a toolbox, paintbrushes, and I would paint during the day because we have a lot of downtime. We just sit around the hotel all day until showtime. So I realized I could make good use of that productively. I will tell you that this has been captured for posterity. I have a website for my art, which is just michaelcardelloni.com. And on that website, there is a painting called Ronnie Van Zant.
I've seen that. We were looking through your website to.
Great. So did you watch the slideshow for the Ronnie Van Zant painting?
I didn't. I didn't find that. I'm sorry.
So for the Ronnie Van Zant painting, there is a slideshow. And then for my self-portrait, there is a slideshow. And basically what that illustrates is still photos of whatever painting I'm working on in a hotel room. And you see the city in the distance out the window. And, you know, it's captioned at the bottom where I am. And it moves from city to city and the painting comes to fruition.
Oh, that's amazing. And
there's one very funny photo in the slideshow for my self-portrait. We were in Canada and I had the painting, which by the way is a drum head. So my self-portrait, painted on the drum head so it looked like a mirror, like I was hitting the drum. The drum head is on the easel by the window of the hotel for the natural light. And I'm sitting there painting in my underwear, like you do. And I hear this knocking sound outside of my window. And I turn my head and there are these pulleys and ropes outside of the window.
Nice.
And up from below comes a window washer who's in a harness with all these carabiners and he's got a squeegee and he gets to my window and he stops and he looks at me and I'm sitting there in my underwear and I just look at him like, yeah, well, here I am. And then I immediately stood up out of frame and took a photo of him hanging outside of the window.
That is amazing.
What's up, guy? That's great.
So with your painting and exhibitions and everything, you kind of joined the ranks of a lot of other rock artists who have established a career in painting. And I'm thinking specifically of Bowie, Cobain, Grace Slick, Paul Stanley. And there's a lot of artists that have done this transition into a painting career. Once Grace stopped performing, she went full time into artwork. Did you get inspiration from any of these people, their work or their career? And have you done any shows with them?
Yes, I was inspired by all of them. Well, first of all, I'm a lifelong Bowie fan, so he can do no wrong for me. Paul Stanley is an old friend. He and I have been friends since Damn Yankee days. And Paul introduced me to Wentworth Gallery. So we both show with Wentworth.
Yeah.
And that was from a kind referral from Paul. We've certainly shared the same galleries. I've had my work hanging up in Soho here in New York City alongside Ron Wood and Ringo and Grace Slick. There are some great painters out there, musician painters, no question about it. And of course, I'm inspired by them because they blazed the trail for the rest of us.
How is working with Wentworth? They have really done a lot with the music community and they have really taken on the rock star, you know, who want to be a painter also and really embrace that and really brought it to public attention. And I love some of the stuff that they've done. How is working with them?
It's been wonderful. They have been showing my work for 14 years now.
Wow.
You know, they took what was just kind of a little cottage industry of my own, selling, you know, artwork online to like bringing it to the big leagues, as it were. And they've been wonderful, and they've been very encouraging and supportive. And they've placed some of my larger scale paintings, and they've really kind of helped me take this art career to the next step.
That's amazing.
I know, Alan, you wanted that. I'm interested too about the Pixelism.
So the Pixelism paintings, which people can see on my website, they're simply images that are pixelated. And I've done them by painting a perfect grid of perfect squares. I will give you the short story. When I was in seventh grade, growing up in Cleveland, we had a field trip for the art class to the Salvador Dali Museum, which at the time was in Cleveland. It's no longer there. And there was one amazing painting, forgive me because I don't remember the name of it, but it is when you're standing up close, it is a woman looking through an archway and out towards a seascape. And then as you back up, it turns into Abraham Lincoln's head. And the painting, it has a very beautifully long, crazy Dali-esque title that I think ends with tribute to Rothko, I think. Anyway, so that visual magic, it just kind of stuck in my head all these years. And then about 7 or 8 years ago, I was sitting at my laptop, and I had a poor internet connection, and something was opening slowly, and it was pixelated, and then it cleared up, and as that was happening, it triggered that memory. Oh, boy, this kind of reminds me of that Dali painting. And by the way, that Dali painting is literally like 20 feet tall. Wow. So you have to go to the other end of the museum to have it focus on you.
That's cool.
So I was sitting there at my desk thinking, oh, you know, I should do a painting that's pixelated, because people have gotten so used to seeing pixelated images while they're waiting for something to load on their computer or phone. It's kind of almost part of the pop culture now. So I thought, I'm going to pixelate something. And then I turned my head to the right, and in the other room, it's actually where I'm sitting. Now, I know we're doing a podcast, but I'm going to show you.
We want to see.
That is a big boy statue. So much to my wife's dismay, I have a 5-foot big boy statue in our apartment holding up the hamburger. And so I'm sitting at my desk across the hall, and I need to pixelate something. And I turned my head to the right, and I saw a big boy, and I thought, and that's what I'm going to pixelate.
Nice.
So I will tell you, all I literally did was take a photograph of him, draw a grid over the top of it with a pencil, and then I just started trial and error. And there was more error than there was trial. I'll tell you that.
I mean, that must take so long to do.
Forever. Because I don't mind telling you, every one of those squares, I use Scotch tape to make perfectly square. And I start in the upper left corner. And when it's done, I pull the tape away. I blow dry it because I use acrylic. It dries quickly. And then I move one to the right and put more tape and paint. And
how do you know first how big, because they're different sizes. How do you even foresee what you.
Part of the, I didn't know at first, Stephanie. And when I did Big Boy, I made the squares 1 inch by 1 inch. So that, just to make his head, turned into a 36-inch by 36-inch painting. So that's 36 squares left to right and up and down. And what I did as I was painting it, I would keep moving away, as like 20 feet away, so my eyes could focus, much like the Dali technique.
Right, right.
And then I would see, oh, I went too quickly into the red. I still need to be a little more yellow. Oh, but I need to have orange in between because that's the color blend. So here's where the 4-year-old art classes probably came in. My color, my color knowledge maybe like triggered back in from the brain cells of a little kid. So with each next Pixelism, I got more comfortable, more aggressive, perhaps, and certainly more adventurous. And then I realized, oh, the bigger the squares are, the softer the focus and the more pop art it is.
Yeah.
The smaller the squares, the more detailed it becomes, and you don't have to move as far enough away. So there is a Pixelism that I did of Mona Lisa.
Yep.
And that painting, I wanted to do more detailed. It has squares that are 3/4 by 3/4 of an inch. And there are 2,200 of them.
Oh.
And it took about 3 months to paint.
Wow. That is amazing.
That's dedication.
It's a doozy, though. That one came out beautifully. That one actually was the cover of Fine Art Magazine that you mentioned earlier.
Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah.
With you being an artist, too, could you kind of talk about this idea of selling your art? I mean, because you're probably making more money off of your artwork than you are off of the Spotify money for any of the other stuff you're doing, right? Can you just kind of talk about navigating that terrain as two different creatives? You're the creative that's making music and is in this really cool musical art form, but then you're doing art. And at the end of the day, it's all, you know, making money and getting your art out there to people, but the rewards are different. So could you just kind of talk about that a little?
Well, you know, the rewards are different, but I guess the first thing I would have to say is, you know, it was never about making money anyway. It was just about the creative expression. If someone likes it enough that they want to buy it, then that's wonderful. But I'm very grateful that people have, you know, bought the art and bought the paintings and or records and or downloads and all of that. But, you know, that's kind of the gravy after the fact.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm working on a painting right now in the other room. I don't know if anyone's going to buy it at the show down in Asheville. I hope they do. If they don't, then I'll bring it back home.
Mm-hmm.
Going from loud to silent, favorite Chaplin movie?
Because you and I share a passion
for it. No, you and I share a deep love for Chaplin, and I love silent film. So we could be here all day just talking about that.
We could. We might have to do a whole other hour. it's The Circus. Chaplin is a lifelong fascination for me. I have friends in the family. I have visited them. They have visited me. They have gone to see Skinner in concert. There's a whole love story with me and the Chaplins.
That's kind of
great,
cool.
Great painting of it, too.
Oh, thank you.
I'm a big fan of his shorts, too. I mean, I know a lot of people don't talk about his short film stuff. But
The Mutuals?
Yeah, those are amazing.
I was in a film history class in 9th grade, and they screened The Gold Rush. That was my true introduction to Chaplin. I knew the image of the tramp because it's so iconic.
Yeah.
That's the first one they showed in mine, too. So I guess that's sort of standard protocol. Yeah. And I've kind of graduated to liking, you know, all of them. But Gold Rush is just still the amount of execution and timing in that is a little, the bar is a little raised for that one.
Okay, I'm going to go off the beeline just a little bit. City Lights.
Yeah.
The party scene where Charlie blows the whistle and someone claps him on the back and he swallows it.
Yeah.
I own the whistle.
Oh, no.
And the first thing I did, well, let me preface this for the listeners out there that aren't familiar with this film. So Chaplin did City Lights when the sound technology had already come into being, but he stuck to his guns and made yet another silent film, but he used the technology for writing a score because Chaplin was a musician and for sound effects. And one of the sound effects is in a scene, Chaplin is blowing this little whistle. Someone hits him, he swallows it, and then he's hiccuping and you're hearing the whistle. So the whistle is the first sound associated visibly on screen that the chaplain that the tramp made. So I bought the auction the whistle at an auction. When I went to pick it up, the very first thing I did was blow the whistle, and it's the exact sound.
Oh, that's awesome!
It's the whistle that Charlie used on the soundtrack.
That's cool. Amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, and it's attached to a little property tag where he wrote Whistle from City Lights, Charlie Chaplin.
Oh, man.
Wow.
Yeah. The only thing I've got is I've got a theater program from when he was younger. That's all I've got, which is
it's all good.
Yeah. Stuff. But that's nowhere as cool as the whistle. So it's also interesting, too, in a parallel to music, is that he is in many ways. He was also kind of in a super group as well.
United Artists.
Yeah, he started United Artists. So I'm wondering, with you being in a super group, did you sort of, when you're going in and you're the new guy in the super group, did you sort of subconsciously think of Chaplin walking into a room with Mary Pickford and Fairbanks?
So this is a beautiful segue, Rob. Yes. Yeah. And you want to know why?
Why?
Damn Yankees recorded its first album at A&M Studios.
Yes.
On the Charlie Chaplin movie.
I was actually getting to that. Yeah. Man. Because I've been there.
No, it's wonderful. It was great to tie the history together. In fact, the first Damn Yankees album has a little CD booklet with this wonderful collage of photos. Mm-hmm. And one of the photos, I'm standing next to a stand-up of Chaplin by the stage door into the big sound stage.
Mm. Nice.
I want to ask you about my favorite painting that I saw on your site, which is called Heartbeat. And I just love the story. You just have a few simple sentences about it, but could you tell everybody about this painting so that when they go to the website, they have a more detailed story?
Sure. Well, thank you. Thank you for bringing that one up, Stephanie. That was just kind of a painting I did on a whim. I did not make any canvas signed and numbered reproductions, which I do quite often with works. Did not make one of Heartbeat. That was a one of one, and you know, it went off to the blue yonder. But the painting is a tip of the hat to the Wizard of Oz, and it's a close-up of the heart-shaped clock that the wizard gives the Tin Man at the end of the film. He wants a heart, and they give him this little clock, and he kind of hangs it on his steel chest there on a rivet. And I don't remember how the idea presented itself. I've certainly watched The Wizard of Oz hundreds of times.
Yeah.
Like most people have. And perhaps I watched it again. And when that scene happened, I saw the clock and I thought, oh, what? Maybe I should do something. So I know for certain that when I worked on the painting, I watched the movie again. Mm-hmm. And when it got to that scene, I hit freeze frame so I could look at the exact time it said on the clock face when the wizard handed the heart to the Tin Man. And that's the time I put on the painting.
That's so fantastic.
I have two favorite pieces that I would love to ask you about. The first one is, it's a painting of the Beatles rooftop concert from Ringo's point of view.
What a great one.
Man, yeah. I love that so much.
So that painting is called Ringo, although he's the one Beatle not in it, but yep. It's about him. You know, that's a vantage point that I have seen for most of my adult life.
Actually, yeah, right.
And you have a painting of your own POV. That
I have thing. Painted my own point yep. of view. You're right. So I had this idea about 15 years ago. Wouldn't it be cool to do a painting that would portray what it felt like to be Ringo and see the other Beatles? Wow. On the other side of the drum kit. And then I followed that with, well, what era should I do? Even though I love the Mop Top era, my favorite Beatle album is A Hard Day's Night. But I thought maybe it should be the rooftop concert because that was their last public performance, even though no one could see them unless they were up on the chimneys.
right.
So I started researching the painting about 15 years ago. And then I never got around to painting it because I have a habit of whenever I come up with an idea for a painting, I put it on a list. They're on my phone now. They used to be just on a piece of paper. And the list keeps growing and growing with ideas that hopefully I will live long enough to paint all of them. So I just never really got around to doing that painting. And then the Peter Jackson Get Back documentary came out.
I could talk to 10 hours about that every day.
It was amazing. And it then made me remember, oh, that's right. I had that idea for that painting. So using the renewed Get Back documentary with all that wonderful footage that we hadn't seen and how it was crystal clear, cleaned up.
Yep.
That gave me more reference material.
Yeah.
Although there still was not the actual reference that I needed. You know, I painted something that didn't exist because no one took a picture sitting at Ringo's kit. So I had to look at a lot of photos of Ringo's kit. And then I literally went to a recording studio and set up a drum kit that looked just like Ringo's with the angles and the heights and everything, and then took photos of it so I could get the correct angle of here's how the drums are actually tilted when you're behind them looking straight out. So, and then I started working on that painting, and it took me a full year to paint.
Wow.
It's huge. It's 5 feet across, 3 feet tall. The drums themselves are full size. So if Ringo had a 12-inch diameter tom-tom in front of him, the painting drum is 12 inches in diameter. So that's it's amazing. Literally as real as it can feel. And then because it's just the way my brain is wired, I am not a spontaneous creator in any way. I'm a research to the nth degree, sketch, plan, research. But before I even put a paintbrush to the canvas, I've already spent a lot of time preparing. And an example of that is the brick and mortar pattern on the buildings across the street.
Yeah.
Mm. I
studied to make sure that they were correct.
That's incredible.
The detail is incredible. The detail is so
very proud of that painting. And that painting, that painting will be represented at the show in Asheville.
Mm-hmm. Oh, fantastic.
Yes. What's the other painting that you like, Alan?
Well, I love all your stuff. I just spent hours looking at your website and just looking over all your artwork. But one of the ones that stood out to me is one of your early pieces, and it's called Dead of Winter. It's almost abstract. There's this American impressionist called John Henry Twachtman who had pieces like this where he would do like landscapes of like snowy things where it's almost indecipherably white with like an accent piece. And I thought that it reminded me so much of that style and everything. And I just want to know the story behind it. I just think it's amazingly gorgeous.
Well, thank you. That is a very early painting. If memory serves, I'm going to say 1986, I painted that.
It says 89 on your website.
It says 89?
It does.
That's not
right. I'm looking at it.
Oh.
I'm going to have
change
to
change that. Yeah.
But I will tell you what did happen in 1989. Ron Nevison, who produced the Damn Yankees first and second album, in 1989, Ron bought that painting.
Oh, really?
Really?
Yeah, Ron Nevison has that painting.
That's so cool.
I honestly don't remember the inspiration for that beyond maybe growing up in Cleveland and being around a lot of snow most of my life.
Right.
It is a beautiful picture, though. I know you had mentioned the Davids and you were curious about.
I love that piece. So it's four paintings of the famous David in four different styles, representing Van Gogh, Picasso, Liechtenstein, and Warhol. And I just think it's an amazing piece. And each panel is 4 feet square. So it's a huge painting.
Yeah. So it's four separate canvases. Each one is 4 foot by 4 foot. The idea was not only to honor the David and Michelangelo, who's one of my favorite artists, but upon seeing the David for the first time, Nancy and I went to Florence on our honeymoon. I was just so captivated by seeing that statue in person. And I thought, I want to paint this, but I just couldn't figure out one way to do it. But I came up with four.
Nice.
And I thought, maybe I'll paint him in four unique styles as a double homage to four different famous painters. And it turned into this kind of representation of 100 years of art history, the way art has developed over 100 years. What I did was I would choose, let's use the Van Gogh inspired painting. Van Gogh is one of my favorite painters as well. I found a Van Gogh painting, one of his self-portraits that I liked as the reference point. And it's a very identifiable painting. If people see my David, they'll immediately know the Van Gogh self-portrait that he did. And I simply just plucked Van Gogh out of it and put David in place and then spent many, many months trying to figure out how to simulate the Van Gogh style. And, you know, I'm lucky enough living here in New York City that I can see a lot of Van Gogh paintings in person. The Starry Night is literally in my hometown. It's great. So, you know, I did the same process. I found a Picasso painting that I liked of an individual. It was actually his girlfriend, Dora Maar. And I just plucked her out of it and plopped David in place and then painted him exactly the same way Picasso painted Dora Maar. And these canvases, the other two, Roy Lichtenstein, Andy Warhol, same process. Find a work of reference, pull the subject out, plop David in place, and then try to become that artist. So it was a fascinating project, and it took a solid year to do those four. And I'm happy to say that all four of those paintings ended up living together because Wentworth Gallery was offering them individually.
Oh.
I kept urging them, if you can find someone to buy all four, I really painted them to live together because of the story and the arc of the history. And I'm happy to say, yes, they live together in a very, very impressive South Beach, Miami penthouse.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
You've done some other of those sort of double homages too. There was a Magritte one, if I remember rightly.
There is, yes. And in fact, the Magritte painting is also in that penthouse in South Beach, Miami.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
So Magritte's one of my favorites. I took his concept of the of how the something changes planes. If there's a figure in the foreground, they somehow get pulled into the subjects in the background, and the colors blend together. So I took that technique and then did a painting of Magritte standing at an easel painting, but he himself has become a victim of his own kind of
job. Yeah.
Yes.
He gets Magritte-ified. He gets pulled
It's
in.
So wonderful. It's great. It's just so, it's really kind of humorous, and I love that one.
Well, I'll tell you a fun thing about that painting. And people could see that on my website if they'd like to see it. It's called The Magritte Condition. The figure, the body standing at the easel is actually me. So I plopped Magritte's head on my body.
All right, Michael, we're going to let you go, man. This has been so fun.
Yeah.
And I totally would love to have you back on because there's so much stuff that we didn't get a chance to cover.
Well, thank you. I would love to be on again. I appreciate your time. Thank you all.
As soon as we end here, I am going to pack a bag, go to bed because I have to get up super early in the morning to fly to Cleveland.
Hey, what are you doing there?
Well, my spouse is doing a business trip, and I'm tagging along just to get my second opportunity to go to the Rock Hall.
Oh, very good, very good. You know, I had some art in the gift shop for a while at the Rock Hall.
Oh,
really?
Yeah. On the website, they're called the Road Series paintings.
Oh, yeah, right.
The red, yellow, green, purple.
Yes,
The little still lives. Mm-hmm. And they were, the Rock Hall was selling posters of that for a while.
Oh, cool. I'm going to look for them.
They're not there anymore.
Ah,
yeah, this is
disappointing.
14 years ago.
Oh, I got you.
Oh, wow.
I got you.
Yeah.
Cool.
Well, once again, thank you so much. This has been an absolute joy.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah, it was great meeting you, Michael. Thank you.
Great to meet you all.
Thank you.
Best luck with the show and everything.
Thank you.
How about those Guardians?
How about it?
Yeah, it's crazy. All right, I'll let you go, man. That's a whole separate thing.
Take care.
Thanks, guys.
Bye, Michael.
In the Cosmic Pizza Podcast, your pizza delivery guys,
Paul,
Dan,
Sean,
Casey,
serve you a slice of life. We talk to women in comedy, voice actors, directors, producers, and authors.
We also talk about conspiracy theories, our top three films of the decade, famous people we confuse with each other, and our favorite stand-up comedians.
We've recast Star Trek and Babylon 5 and created alternate superheroes.
But most of all, we have had so much fun doing it every 2 weeks.
2 weeks!
Cosmic Pizza Podcast is not about the cosmos or pizza.
Oh my gosh.
Oh, wow. Yay. He's so great.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. God, that was so fun.
Oh, that was, yeah, I could have talked to him about so many more paintings and so much more stuff like that. But yeah, it would be cool to have him on again.
So we will be back next week. And until then, Stephanie, why don't you kick us off with where people can find you?
You can find me on Facebook at Stephanie Seymour Music. You can find me on Instagram at @their_r_birds. And I have a website, therearebirds.com. And you can find me on Bandcamp under my name, Stephanie Seymour. And of course, on all these streaming platforms like Spotify and stuff like that.
All right, Anthony.
You can also find me on the Watchers in the Fourth Dimension podcast, watching our way through all of Doctor Who from 1963 until now. We are on Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and all of those other places wherever you like to get your podcasts. And you can also follow us on social media at Watchers4D on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, or X, or whatever the fuck it's called this week.
Right.
And you can also find me personally on Instagram at @EnglishmanInATL.
Rob, how about you?
So you can find me on Facebook or the Twitter X planetary mess that is. Also on Post under my name. And you can find me on the radio on Wednesday nights on KDHX 88.1 FM in St. Louis. Streaming at KDHX.org. So you can listen to that on the archive stream whenever you want. It's there for you to listen to whenever. Also, I host a show on Louder Than War Radio on Monday nights from 6 to 8 Greenwich Mean Time. And then that's 1 to 3 Eastern, 12 to 2 Central. It's called Antics. You can listen to that there. And I'm also on the Weekend Justice podcast for IndieCoffee.com.
All right. And I've got a website that catches all of my nonsense in one place, and that is Cosmic Creative. CozMicCreative.com. You can find my books. You can find my podcasts. And I don't know, maybe I'll put out a coloring book and you can find that there too. I don't know. So we will be back soon. Hope you'll stick around with us. Until then, take care. Keep rocking on. And we'll see you soon.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.